if I asked you, how much money do you want to be paid for you to spend the rest of your life doing something you don't like? Most people would be like, damn, like millions, you know, like at least like, you know, $600,000. It's like, well, you're not going to get paid that, you know, as a doctor. And if you don't like it, you're basically saying that you're willing to just spend your life, you know, like your one life doing this. And then at the end of it, just be like, well, that sucked.
In 1837, Horace Mann created the education system, a system at the time designed to pump out factory workers and professors. The same system that is still being used today in the 21st century. Now, Mann's system is backfiring. We are being molded by the same industrial system that has existed for close to 200 years. That system delivers us into a digital economy that has no need of our outdated skills. This isn't our teachers' fault. This isn't the government's fault. This is due to a rapidly changing world full of technology and unforeseen circumstances. And us Gen Zs are caught in the middle. Welcome to the Driven Young Podcast, the podcast for stressed, overwhelmed young Australians, teaching you practical life skills you can implement now to set yourself up in life. And now your host, Byron Dempsey.
Welcome back to the Driven Young Podcast, and boy do I have an epic episode for you today. Out of all the episodes I have done, I feel like this episode encapsulates what the show is about best, and I highly recommend listening to the entire episode because it's a long one. Today I'm joined by Dr. Justin Sung. Dr. Justin is a former medical doctor turned learning coach. He's passionate about helping people use genuinely effective learning strategies that work for everyone, not just a few high achievers. Unlike in medicine where your practice has to be tied to research, he realized how the common practices by schools and students weren't as evidence-based as they were hyped up to be. He also saw how this directly caused stress, demotivation, procrastination, and anxiety for students who kept putting in effort and didn't see results. Since 2011, Justin has worked with over 10,000 students across over 100 countries. He's a co-founder of ICANN Study, an organization that specializes in learning skills, and is involved in the novel research at Monash University, looking at the effectiveness and efficiency of learning strategies. In this episode, we cover his journey becoming a doctor, what it's like when he quit medicine, the different types of learning and how we can learn effectively, his opinions on the modern education system, growing to 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, and much, much more. As per usual, please DM my myself or Justin on Instagram if you enjoyed the episode. Join my Sydney program or sign up to my 20-week challenge via the links in the show notes below. And please consider giving this podcast a rating or review. That would really mean the world to me. Now, over to Dr. Justin.
Justin, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here.
Thanks. Very excited. Yeah. You reached out to me, like over a year ago. I said I wanted to get you on, but I do all my podcasts in person. So I've just been waiting for you to come to Sydney since then, and COVID's happened and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
So good to finally have you.
Finally made it over.
And congratulations on 100K.
Oh, thanks.
Just hit 100K on YouTube. So that, we'll definitely talk about that. But before we get into the conversation, I'd just love to know, what did you do after high school? And what was kind of like the process and the thought process for you?
So straight after high school, I went into try to get into medical school. So I'm from New Zealand. And in New Zealand, you don't go straight from high school to medical school. You have like a year called, it's called pre-med. And in that year, you have to get the grades and send an interview into this test. And if your grades are high enough, you get into medical school. So that was kind of like my track. And I went down that way and studied like freaking crazy to just get into medical school. Made my way into medical school and then just ended up graduating medical school. Worked as a doctor for a couple of years. Starting from my second year of uni, I started kind of getting into education space, like originally like just tutoring students, you know, because it was something that I was good at. Like I'd done some stuff before. And after that, that just kind of got more and more. I got more involved in education. I set up my own business around it. And then I eventually realized like tutoring wasn't really changing anything. So I started thinking about how to teach people how to learn more effectively. And fast forward now, that's what I do full time. Like I just help people to learn more efficiently.
And so how long did you study to be a doctor in New Zealand? What's that?
So it's 6 years of uni. In the middle, I took a year to do an honors as well. So it was a Bachelor of Medical Science honors program, which is a research year where I researched some stuff on eyes and published some stuff in some journals. And then went back into my final year of medical school, finished that off, and then graduated.
Yeah. And did you enjoy being a doctor, or you just enjoy teaching more, or was it like...
Okay. So like I enjoyed some parts of being a doctor. But the thing is like there are parts about being a doctor that you don't really know until you are a doctor. And there are some parts of the career that no one really talks about. And so I didn't really know any of that stuff. So that stuff really was quite jarring. And I did not like that about medicine and working as a doctor. Education was something that I was pretty passionate about. So like, you know, the thing that I often say is like, while I was going through uni and even while I was working as a doctor, I was consistently doing like 100 hours a week. Wow. Because I was doing, you know, like studying for medical school. But then on the side, I'd be working like 30, 40 hours a week on like education related stuff, or like building a business. Well, it was a nonprofit actually, just on education. And then when I was working as a doctor, like I'd be going from ward to ward, and in the stairwell, like in between, I'd be like taking calls. Like throughout, I guess like 7 years, I was kind of always like involved in education, and people always asked me, you know, how I was able to do like 120 hours a week, like consistently for that long. But I sort of said like, well, it's because I'm doing all of this stuff that I'm even able to go through and do like my doctoring job. Cause it was like another avenue, like a way of me to think about things, like a way of engaging my brain. And, I sort of realized that I was a lot more driven, like passionate. Like I'd get home and be keen on just working on education and like teaching theories and like learning principles. And when I had spare time, like it's like the nerdiest thing. Like when I had spare time, I would like read research articles on learning psychology. You know, like I never in my spare time decided to read about like medical articles.
Yes.
You know, so that was kind of a sign. I was like, okay, maybe I've got more of sort of this kind of passion, I suppose.
And curiosity.
Yeah, and just inherent interest in education. And by the end of it, I was really not liking my job as a doctor. I was dreading waking up the next day. You know, it was like Sunday evening. I was like, oh, damn it, like I have to go to work tomorrow. Like I hated that feeling. It's been a long time since I felt that, since I've gone into education. So,
well, yeah. Good on you for making that. Because I mean, that's a huge decision to make, because you've just invested like, what, 7 years of your life to be like, nah, I'm switching.
Yeah.
A lot of people will be
$110,000 of student loan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like the sunk cost fallacy, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people will succumb to that, be like, well, I've done all this work, I might as well use it. And it's like, well, not at the cost of being miserable for the rest of your life. It's like focus on, for you, you identified that you were more curious in education and research. Yeah. It's the same as me. I read stuff like that on learning as well. I read really boring books because I'm interested in, you know, the Finnish education system and why that's so effective versus Australia's.
Yeah.
Like it's really boring, but then also I enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause like a lot of students have asked me, cause like, obviously it's not, I guess it's not like that many people that students and other people know of that went through being a doctor, which like a lot of people consider as a sort of dream job. And then left to do something else.
Especially so quickly.
Yeah, and also like that are in the education space and like do coaching and mentoring and stuff. So they sort of see that I'm someone that they can ask for this stuff. So a lot of people ask me about this. And the consistent thing that I try to preach is that you really have to think about like, what is the outcome in life that you're really looking for here? Like job security is one thing. But job security really means like you're able to have enough money to put food on the table and pay for the bills. And the amount of money you need to make to put food on the table and pay for the bills is not extremely high. Like you don't need to be on a $150,000 salary to put food on the table and pay for your bills.
Do you know what it is in Australia?
What?
They say $70,000 to $75,000 is to live a good life, pay rent and everything. That's what you need in Sydney, apparently.
Yeah. And Sydney is
one of the most expensive.
Yeah, you know?
Exactly. And that's 70 grand, which again, it's a lot, but you could get a 70 grand job pretty easy.
You can get Sydney. A 70 grand job in so many different fields that, you know, may align more with your inherent interests, right? So it's like, okay, so like, what are you even looking for here? Like if there's that stability and you're able to get that stability doing anything, then what else do you want out of your job? You know, yes, more money is great. And I'm not saying that, you know, just be poor for the hell of it.
Of course.
But, you know, at a certain point, it's kind of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
So the question I ask instead is like, how much money would you need to be paid? Like if I asked you, how much money do you want to be paid for you to spend the rest of your life doing something you don't like? Most people would be like, damn, like millions, you know, like at least like, you know, $600,000 is like, well, you're not going to get paid that, you know, as a doctor. And if you don't like it, you're basically saying that you're willing to just spend your life, you know, like your one life doing this. And then at the end of it, just be like, well, that sucked.
Yeah.
But at least, you know, I don't know, like,
status.
My parents gave me a pat on the back. Yeah. Or like you had the status or whatever it is.
And you got to say I'm a doctor and everything.
Yeah, you get to write doctor on your on your travel like information. It's like, you know, when they ask for your title for your like credit card, it's like doctor.
Bro, I've seen TikToks of people saying they're like I $100,000 of debt, all this, but at least I get to put doctor on it.
It's the dumbest thing. It's really the
I know dumb. They're joking, but I think there's still a level that's kind of true.
Bro, I honestly don't think they're like really joking, because there are a lot of people that have that. There's like so much emphasis on that status, and like I get it. Like I get why you would want to have like prestige and status.
Yeah, of course. It's human nature.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not like it's inherently a bad thing to have like a certain status, but it's just it's not worth your whole life career going through.
It's the external validation versus the internal validation. Yeah, and a lot of status is external, but there's not internal. It's funny. You haven't read this, have you?
I actually haven't read it.
You should read it. I'll give you a copy. But if you read my chapter, it's all about a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah. This almost this exact example. I created two fictional characters. One went to be a doctor for the wrong reasons. And I unpack what was going on in his head for the status because his parents wanted him to and everything. And the other person was like started a business and traveling Europe making like 30 grand a year, but she was much happier.
Yeah.
And so it's funny this example is so inherent to, I guess, my story, which I made up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super, super common as
Very
well.
Very common.
Yeah. I mean, even if it's not about like pleasing someone else, sometimes you get this internalization of expectations. Like you think it's what you want, but you're not able to even explain it. Like, why do you want it? You know, often you don't even know.
Well, it's like fitting in with your friends because everyone goes to uni. So you want to be going to uni. There's a big one I talk about as well. I'd be curious to see if you agree. From like 0 to 18, every year, you know what's happening next.
Mm-hmm.
You're in year 7, you're in year 8 the next year, then you're in year 9. You might move countries, stuff might happen, someone might die, but at least you know that. And then we hit 18, and for the first time in your life, you have no idea what's happening afterwards. Yeah. And so what do? We jump straight into a degree or a job to fill that void.
Yeah.
Or we people say, I'm in a degree to buy myself 3 years, and then I'll do my master's, and it buys me 5 years to avoid becoming an adult. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money and time to just be killing when you could be take a year off, figure out what you want to do and really, go back to that curiosity thing. What makes you curious?
Yeah, 100% agree, because like even me now, because I'm about to start a PhD in education, one of my lecturers actually pulled me aside and be like, you need to just make sure like you know exactly what you're getting out of your PhD.
Right.
Because she was like, I see way too many, and she's actually a researcher in the employability space. Like her job is to know about the value of a degree. And what she actually said was like a lot of people go into PhD for that reason. It's just an extension of this railroad that they're on.
Yeah.
They're just putting off kind of facing life and its infinite possibilities.
Yeah.
And then as a result, they kind of get into this, they get out of a PhD and then they don't really know what to do with it. It's not actually getting them the job that they wanted.
Mm.
So I think medicine is like a great example of that, where you just have this fixed pathway that you go on. And on top of that, there's positive reinforcement. Like if someone says, hey, what do you want to do? What do you want to be when you grow up? And you say, I want to be a doctor. It's like, pat on the back, Oh, hey, look, your family like tells everyone, they want to be a doctor. You feel good about it. And now this uncertainty is gone. You feel great. Like, you know what you want to do. You don't have that uncertainty anymore. And then you can say, yeah, I want to be a doctor. But then do you really, like when you actually start working in it, is it actually worth it? So the thought process that went through my head when I was working as a doctor, I was like, okay, people are all saying that like leaving medicine is risky, but why is it risky? Like if my number one outcome for my life is that I want to do work that I find is fulfilling and meaningful, but also, which I think medicine did do, but also like is aligned a little bit more with my personality, with the life that I want to live, that aligns more with some of my other values and priorities as well. I did not see medicine providing me that life. So in that case, staying in that track would have been a really risky move, as opposed to moving into something that I thought could take those boxes.
We know Casey Neistat.
What was that?
You know Casey Neistat?
Yeah.
Yeah, one of his quotes, he was like, the most dangerous thing you can do in your career, the most dangerous thing you can do in life is play it safe.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think, especially in the modern world, it's like, oh, play it safe, stay as a doctor. It's safe to stay as a doctor. You've got the income, you've got everything. You're validated by everyone in society, all this stuff. But it's like, at the cost of what? You being happy?
Yeah.
And so it's good to see that you jumped, because I know a lot of people who don't. And the three ones I see, whether you agree or not, I know you've worked with a lot. Medicine, for sure.
Yeah.
Law.
Yeah.
There's so many people in law and psychology.
Yeah.
The amount of people I know who are going into psychology, not aware that they have to, how first of all, only 10% of students can even make it.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to do 5 years, because it's 3 years, and then another 2 years to get your master's to be a practicing psychologist. Mm-hmm. It's like there's so many steps, and it sounds smart, like, oh, doing psychology.
Yeah.
It's like, but do you know what you're doing with it? do you know how you can apply this? And it's just, this is a huge thing I talk about on the podcast, because just so many people are dropping out or switching because they've just jumped into it without thinking, what do I actually want to do? And it, that's why I started the intentional gap year program.
Because
I'm a big fan of gap year, taking some time off to really sit and think, what do I want to do with my life? What are my personalities? What interests me?
But the issue is that a lot of young people, they don't sort of, not that I'm like not a young person, I guess, but a lot of people, when you say it, like when you're in high school, it's just, I mean, if a gap year is not like what you're conditioned to already think is like normal and good for you, like you may hear it, but then what you, what I found is that what they think in the background is like, for everyone else, not for me though.
Yeah,
like, for me, it's different,
so true,
you know?
So true.
And it's like, it's just kind of, it's like this weird sort of thing where like the messages may be so true. The only people that really resonate with it are the people that already like made the mistake, and all the people that have yet to make the mistake are just like, I don't know, just they're sort of like, oh, it's such a good thing. Let me share it with my friends. This applies to you guys. Not for me though, but like, let me, you know, tell my friends about it. Except for the, you know, obviously like the rare few exceptions.
Because that was kind of always been my logic. When I hear people, consistently people saying something, for example, my parents and a lot of people that I respect have always said, don't buy a brand new car. It's a really poor investment when you don't have much money. If you got lots of money, do what you want. But if you don't have much money, don't just get a secondhand car. And so I never had a desire to get a brand new car because I've seen so many people make that mistake.
Right.
And so for my logic was like, and this is very logical thinking, well, if everyone's saying that, then it must be bad. And it's same with this thing. It's like if everyone's saying don't jump into it, that it must be the right thing to do. But then some people just need to make the mistake in order to appreciate
the thing
it.
Is that's not what everyone is saying actually.
It's it's not. No,
exactly. That's what the thing is.
No, no, 100%.
All right. So you're saying like if it becomes more the normal kind of.
Yeah, yeah. And I think maybe I'm in a bit of an echo chamber of people like you have similar beliefs to me. And so maybe I forget that most people still hear the same message of go to school, get a high ATAR, which is our system here. You know, go to university, get university, leverage that to get a job, and then you're done.
Yeah. But it's not. And you know, one of the things is like I do these consultations with like parents and their kids, right?
Mm.
You know, parents will bring their kids in and be like, Justin, you know, they don't know what to do. They're lost in life, blah, blah, blah. And and then I just talk, I go to the parent and I'm just like, so at what age do you feel like you really figured out, you know, and you thought like my life is like exactly the way that I wanted. Like I figured out life. And then they're like, oh, well, you know, I mean, just not really, you know, it's not really about us, you know. It's like, do you feel like you've figured out your life right now? And then like they haven't, you know, they're just as, it's a different context.
Yeah.
They're just as lost essentially. They're just figuring out different things. And I just think it's absurd that they are then placing those same things on this other person. You know, they sort of learned this lesson about life that you can't figure things out like super early. It doesn't really work that way. You have to make mistakes, you know, all of that sort of stuff. You have to figure out your path and all of that sort of stuff. They figured that out after living for 30, 40, 50 years. And then they just withhold all of that from their child. And it's like, cool, go make the exact same mistakes that we made.
Yeah. It's mind boggling. Yeah. Trust me. It's mind boggling. Like parents are just bigger kids with bigger marks.
Yeah, it actually is.
They're honestly.
Yeah.
It's like we see this, all the issues with Empower You, with the young kids, when they write on the, without going into it, they write what their issues down.
Yeah.
We do the same thing with parents. The same
stuff.
It's the
same, yeah.
Because it comes back from our childhood. From 0 to 7, 95% of who you are is developed.
Mm. I've done similar stuff in like my own workshops and work where I like look at, you know, what the parents think and say and their beliefs and stuff and then what the kids have and just mirrors each other completely. And it's like you are actually, you know, it's just enclosed box of the problem. And what we need to do is not just stay in this box to solve the problem because that's what the problem is. Like what we need to do is just open up that box and really look at things a little bit more objectively.
Yeah.
Have advice like this, basically.
Yeah, because I mean, I would love to chat with some. I've got some parents I'd love to have a chat with, who have very strong beliefs, and I don't want to go in and rote. You know, I just want to have a civil chat with them. But I think it's very, you have a lot more power than me because you've gone through it. I never went to university because I saw it straight away. I had so many people, and I recognized it. I went in the business world and I saw this, and I started to identify. Okay, there's clearly an issue here. So I was lucky in that sense. But you kind of went through it, so you've got the grounding to be like, look. I'm a doctor.
Yeah.
I can tell you as a doctor, here's what it's like and blah, blah, blah.
You know, the funny thing is that like, especially for like Asian immigrants, they respect doctors a lot.
Yes.
It's a cultural thing. And when I'm in a consultation with parents, often they have like a irrational level of respect for me to the point where like I could be directly criticizing what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they like don't feel that they have the like, they can be offended by it because they just like putting me too much on a pedestal. And I'm like, normally this is a problem. But right now this is quite useful for us to like have this conversation. But unfortunately, and I've had a lot of conversations. Like, you know, I've been in this space now for like 8-9 years. I've had a lot of conversations with parents over the years, and it's really, 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 I would say less than 1% of the conversations that I've had with parents have actually resulted in parents really reconsidering. Even if we get to the point where they understand the issues, they agree with it, they empathize with it, they see the problem, I think a big part of it is that they don't know how else to be. That's just a habit. Whenever there's an issue,
ingrained.
It's super ingrained. That's how they live their life. That's how their parents told them to live their lives. That's how they've raised their kid for the first 14 to 18 years.
I mean, it's funny you say like they have a lot of respect for you, because it's almost opposite for me, because I don't have that status. Right. And I've done everything completely non-traditionally.
Yeah.
And so parents have very little respect.
Right. Because you need to build up even more cred for yourself.
I'm a TikToker, right? I'm not a TikToker. I just post on TikTok. I'm a professional presenter, podcaster. I've studied education not officially. That's the other issue. Mm-hmm. People won't respect because I haven't formally studied it, but I've read so many books. I've interviewed 120 people talking about education and what we should be learning. I've connected with some of the greatest educational creators, you know, people with PhDs like yourself, people who've studied all this stuff, because it's not formally educated. I don't get the same respect.
Yeah.
So I'm on the opposite spectrum.
Well, you know, like the reason that I pursue like these qualifications, a big part of it, like I'm inherently interested in the research and I want to, it's a good way to connect with, you know, academics and stuff like that, blah, blah, blah. But like, at least 40 to 50% of it is just that it lubricates the conversation.
Yeah.
When someone, you know, when I have a statement, if it comes with this qualification backing it, it's like, okay, justification is inherent, is implicit. We don't have to have this lengthy conversation about, you know, me explaining the rationale for every single conversation I have. And
whether the information's the same or not.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The information could be exactly the same. And, trust me, like, in fact, even just, because I first went into like business and education when I was 21.
Mm.
When I was 21 versus now, I'm 28 now.
Mm.
Giving the essentially the same advice, the reception is completely different. Just because like I'm a little older, so they.
Yeah.
But it's just like it was the exact same thing. If you think about the logic behind it, each point was in itself irrefutable. There's no way if you just thought about it, it can be refuted. You know, if you really thought about it. But it's about whether they're even willing to entertain thinking about it in the first place.
There's that quote, it's like the sign of an intelligent person is your ability to entertain a new idea.
Mm.
Therefore, so the sign of an idiot is your inability to entertain a new idea.
Yeah.
A little bit of a joke there.
Yeah.
But no, it's so true, isn't it? It's like whether I truly believe someone who's intelligent can entertain any idea. If someone says something that completely goes against all your beliefs, do you have the intelligence just to entertain it? Not adopt it, just entertain it. And this is all I ask for parents and stuff. And similar to you, 21 to 28, you know, I get a lot more respect now. I have followers. My opinions haven't changed.
Yeah.
Everything I'm saying is the same, but I've got the followers to back it up, which is stupid.
Yeah.
And I've even thought about getting a psychology degree so that when I'm at EmpowerU and I'm teaching young people all these skills, parents just have a little bit more respect, even though I would not teach anything differently. Everything we teach is backed by, you know, studies that have been done from people over like 30, 40, 50 years. We're not creating the content. We just repackage it in a way that's a bit more digestible.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing communication skills are based on studies done in the 1920s on how we communicate emotion, body language, tone of voice, then the words we use and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think having a degree would, and that is where I think a lot of people still think having that degree is important.
Bro, like,
regardless of whether they need it.
Yeah.
It's just a piece of paper, isn't
it? Yeah. But honestly, like positions like ours is definitely not what people are thinking of when they're getting the degree. Like, they're not thinking about like someone believing them when they have a particular conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, you probably should actually consider maybe it just because your line of work makes it so that
it
legit could actually save you so much time.
I might one day. I totally will. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
And one good thing that I think, and like, I need to give credit where credit is due, is that like, first of all, I'm not telling people like, for example, with medicine, I'm not saying
don't go do medicine,
what I'm encouraging is that you have a process of decision-making. Don't be so quick to jump to the decision. Mm. Have a process, be open-minded. One big question I have is, when I used to like do huge sort of, seminars and groups, pre-COVID, you know, where we had like hundreds of people in a room.
Yeah.
And I'd say, hey, you know, put your hand up if you want to do medicine. And of course, everyone puts their hand up because it's a seminar about medicine and, you know, things like that. And then I say, okay, keep your hand up if you feel like you're really, really sure, like you really want to do medicine. And then most people will keep their hand up. And I say, okay, keep your hand up if this is something that you feel like you want to do for a long time and you're really, really motivated to do what it takes to achieve this and become a doctor. And most people will keep their hand up, right? At this point, 95% of the room still has their hand up. And say, okay, keep your hand up if you can explain to me what the medical training program is like, what you're expected to do, and what life as a doctor is like on an everyday basis, and what the career progression of medicine is like. 90% of the room puts their hands down. And I'm like, okay, well, let's try a different question. Put your hand up if you wanted to do medicine. Hands go up.
Yeah.
Okay. Put your hands up if there is another career that you have looked at just as much and considered just as seriously as medicine. You know, most of the hands go down again. So it's like, why are you so confident about this decision when you have no idea what the job involves, you have no idea what the training involves, and you haven't even considered any of the alternatives? Yeah. Like, if you were buying...
Any other scenario,
other scenario in life,
you're psychotic.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, with careers, and especially something like medicine and law, I think those two, like, especially...
They're the big ones.
You know, you just, there's this the societal response where as soon as someone locks into that, that's like, that's it. You've got it. You're going to be, you know, that's your path that's set for you. And then you just get deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And at some point, that's going to be your life.
I would even add a third hand up question. Keep your hands up if you'd be a doctor if you only got paid $75,000 a year.
Oh, do you know what? I've actually asked similar questions to that before.
Yeah.
Everyone keeps their hand up. Because the thing is, when you're really young, you actually don't have a concept of what the salary means to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're used to getting like, I don't know, 100, 200 bucks, you know? And it's like big money if you get paid like something, you know, in the thousands. So if you know, you don't actually have an understanding of like how much it means. But like every professional kind of knows, like when you start working and there's actually like a monetary value set for your time and you start realizing this is my time on this earth. Like my life is measured in this time and this is how much my time is actually worth. And you say like, this is the value. The money becomes real irrelevant real fast. And then you start thinking, what else would I rather be doing?
Yeah. Opportunity costs, right?
Yeah.
I always talk about opportunity costs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and that's the one thing. Cause most people are probably going to go to university.
Yeah.
My big message is make sure you're making it on the right reasons.
Yeah.
Right. Same as you.
Yeah.
But like an argument I always get is, well, if you had someone with a degree and someone without a degree, they're much better off. Yes, but you're not factoring what this person could have done in the 4 years it took them to get this degree.
Yeah, I think it's a very narrow way to view it, to say that this person with a degree is going to actually be better off. In fact, I would really argue that to get the person to explain, why is it? Explain to me in what way this person actually is better off. I really think people will struggle to actually explain it. It's probably just this feeling that they have that they'd be generally in a better position. But
they're not factoring in what this person could. I don't have a degree.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot in the past 4 years. A lot of my friends are just finishing their degrees now. Yeah. And I could get a lot of high paying jobs in marketing if I wanted to.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really happy with how I'm going with my life. I'm you know, presenting, doing all this cool stuff. And it's like, but I don't have a degree. Mm-hmm. And it's like opportunity costs.
Yeah.
4 years is and opportunity costs, I guess, of money. You know?
And one interesting thing is like when I was working as a doctor, okay, in New Zealand, like these are New Zealand numbers here.
Yeah.
So but it's sort of similar. When I was working as a doctor in my first year out, I was getting paid something along the lines of $80,000 to $90,000. Mm-hmm. Okay, kind of varied depending on the run. But New Zealand dollars.
So let's say 110 Australian or maybe 100.
No, other way. It would be...
Is New Zealand dollars worth more?
Sorry. It would be, so if I was getting paid like 80, like 90,000 New Zealand dollars, that would be equivalent to maybe like 70,000 Australian.
New Zealand dollars 75. Okay. Wow. Okay, cool.
Like the value of the currency is less.
Right.
So we need, Australian dollars.
So like a pretty standard wage.
It's high for a first year out of university, but it's not like crazy high I've got friends who are like working in like big corporations or like banks or whatever, and you know they're starting off at I don't know like 70 or 80 and then they're progressing up in 4 years after working they're making 150 170 right, whereas you know they may be working like half the hours, half the stress, for example. When I swapped from full-time medicine to full-time education and running my own business. My business was not at that time established enough. I wasn't able to actually pay myself properly. So I paid myself $37,000. So I took like a $60,000 pay cut almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Last year I paid myself $39,000.
Yeah. But the thing is, the amount of money you need to do a job you don't like is a lot more than the money you need when you're doing something you do like. Because there's extra money that you need to make up for the fact that you're doing something you don't like.
Whereas, big holidays and everything.
Exactly. Whereas when you're doing something you enjoy, inherently you are filling your time with something that you find meaning and fulfillment and satisfaction in doing. Your life is enjoyable inherently, and you have found a way to somehow financially fund that enjoyable life. So now it's like the value of money is not, let's work this crap job so that I can get paid heaps of money so I can enjoy my life. It's like, let's enjoy my life and find a way to live, like fund it, fund a life that I enjoy. And I think if people sort of shift their perspective in terms of what they're trying to get out of career, out of just making money, but instead doing something they actually really find meaning in and just making whatever they need to make to, you know, fund it, I think people will probably make a lot of, I theorize people might make different decisions, although whether they actually would, I don't know.
And two things to add there. Number one is if you love what you're doing, you can work way harder. I could not work the hours I work on my business if I was in a job.
No way. There's no way I'm going to do 120 hours a week as a doctor.
No way. Like I love what I do. I wake up excited and stuff. And I know that's, you know, the privilege, but I've built my way up here and everything. And the second thing was, there's this great story. And I had, like, let's say you took like a teacher or something, or someone on a, I think, I can't remember the numbers, so just don't look too much at the numbers, but it's something, let's say a teacher works 40 hours a week. And their wage is, you know, $80,000. And that broke down to be like $29 an hour. If you had someone who's working 80 hours a week, but their wage is $160,000, same hourly wage. Yet the teacher gets way more free time and freedom. You know what I mean?
So, like, it's a funny thing because, like, doctors are considered like a high paying salary normally. If you actually work it out per hour, because you do a lot of overtime hours. And a lot of that is, like, you know, off the clock essentially. The actual per hour that you get is probably less than if you were to just get like a high position at McDonald's. So in New Zealand, where overtime is not even paid for, actually a lot of countries overtime is not paid at all. I think Australia, you actually do get paid for overtime, which is actually frankly pretty rare.
Nurses get paid overtime.
Yeah,
I think they doctors, get good money in the overtime as well.
In New Zealand, for example, you don't get paid overtime. And so if you actually worked out the hours, you, I think you end up getting paid $15 an hour cash in hand. So it's like 20 something, you know, before tax and all that stuff. But you actually get like
net income.
Like, who the hell is going to, you know, look at $15 an hour and be like, oh, such a high paying job, you know, like great salary.
And your time for money.
And the stress and the emotional burden, because you take that work home with you because, you know, it's high stakes kind of profession.
And again, if you're passionate and you want to be a doctor to help people and you're fascinated by the chemistry and like the human body and everything, and you know that's what you want to do it for the right reasons, go for it. But it's just a big financial and time commitment to make if you're doing it for the wrong reasons. And it's, we talk about doctors a lot, doctors, lawyers, and psychology, because they're very high status and people often want to achieve those because of external validation. It's that dreaded question for the, like, the five years you finish high school, you get asked, so what are you doing with your life? We want to have an answer for that, right?
I really think we should stop asking that question.
Terrible question, right? And like, even my mom, like, I was so lucky. My parents were very open-minded. They're totally okay with me just taking time off to figure out what I wanted to do. But even she said, there's a little part of her when she was with the other parents and all my friends went to university and they're like, so what's Byron doing now? And they're like, oh, he's just figuring it out. There's a part of her that felt less.
You know, like, and I think the good thing about like conversations like this, as it reaches more people, if that were my kid, they were figuring things out, I would be so proud.
So would I.
Legitimately, 100%, I would be so proud that my kid is actually mature enough, open-minded enough, understands critical things enough to figure their own stuff out. And they're actually taking ownership of their life to a level that most people are not. And like, you know, your mom's like more open-minded than the norm.
Definitely.
How many parents are out there that actually would have a state of mind that would not only just like accept it, but actually encourage it and actually legitimately be proud of it? So few.
Bro, it's, Empower You is, we run it for, I mean, we get a lot of people who, their parents come at the end of the night. So it's so difficult because we run a personal development program, but then the parents are the ones who normally pay. So we spend 2 days giving these kids an amazing time, but the parents haven't experienced it. So we then bring in the parents and we do a bit of a 3-hour kind of workshop, and then we sell to the parents and the kids and everything. And I can't, it blows, we get really high percentage of conversions, but it still blows me away how many don't sign up. It's like, if my kid came to me and said, Mom, Dad, I want to double down on investing, financial literacy, goal setting, communication skills, and surround myself with people who are making me happy and not toxic, like my friends at school. And they go, no, we're not going to pay it. You know, yeah. It's a payment plan over 2 years. It's okay. Not even that much.
I need to tell you the story.
Breaks my heart.
You're gonna like. Well, yeah, your heart's about to shatter. Like, bro, I gotta tell you a story.
I got one after it as well.
I was talking about this on another like podcast that I was doing the other day, and I had this student. Working in this space, I get a lot of people coming to me as like their only sort of counsel that they get, because they can't talk to their parents about it. They're not really happy to talk to their friends about it, and they sort of see me as kind of like a figure
outsider.
No, but like some like a figure that they can kind of trust for this type of advice.
Yes.
And so a lot of like mental health things, you know, I'm often like the first person to pick up on it because of the fact that they are only talking to me about it. So every now and again, there's a student that I'm really, really fearful for, to the point where I'll call the police to get really them well. Taken into the hospital or something because I have fear for safety of their life. And so there was one of these students that I was working with, and I've been working with them for a long time, like a year and a half actually. And I'd seen kind of like that they were really, really struggling. They were going to enter into medical school. That was their big goal. And they were studying like crazy, you know, putting their heart and soul, blah, 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 all that stuff into it. And they were coming to me saying like they were really, really depressed. And it was very clear that they were very depressed. I wouldn't have to be a doctor to know it. Like they were clearly depressed, and they were clearly very depressed for a very long time.
Yeah.
You could see the, you know, the, sort of the light in their eyes was like dimming over the year that I had seen him.
I know I've seen it before.
Yeah. And it's sad. And you also know that there's so little that you can really do, you know, about that if their environment is actually causing that. And for them, it was actually their parents, especially their dad, was pushing a lot of this pressure on them. So this kid actually did something really brave. And I commend, it didn't turn out well for him, like after doing this, but I still commend him for this, is that he actually spoke to his dad about this. And they come from a culture where like mental health is not something that you really talk about. You know, it's common in a lot of Asian cultures. You know, mental health is under the table sort of thing. Same in most of the world actually, but especially so in some countries. He talked to his dad about it, and his dad's response was, "It doesn't matter if you're depressed as long as you're a doctor."
Oh my gosh.
And he said, "It's okay for you to be depressed. Just be a doctor." So his dad just said, like, essentially said, just, "I don't even care about how you feel. You can be depressed. Like, it's fine. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters more than you being a doctor." And eventually they had to pull out of the program because they were incapable of actually finishing it. You know, the university had to get involved because it was, you know, too much. I actually haven't actually heard what's happened to them since, because they kind of sort of went off the radar, but like these types of things are actually really common. Not always to that extreme, but sometimes the parents think, you know, have good intentions, but like really don't understand how damaging their behaviors and words and ideas can really be, because they just don't have that perspective. They don't really understand that.
Very rarely are parents trying to be bad parents and like trying to give bad advice. It's all from a good place of love,
yes,
but that doesn't mean it's right.
Yes.
And again, is there right or wrong? And you can parent different ways, but the world's changed. And this is a key thing. Our parents or the older generations, I don't think they should understand, because it's tricky. Like, and especially for like a lot of parents, my parents were first people in their family to ever go to university.
Yeah.
And so they want to put that opportunity on their children. And obviously I'm lucky my parents didn't force it on me. But, you know, they still definitely encouraged it and whatnot. It's just, it's crazy. We had one girl at the end of the program where we do best things, and they got on the mic, and one girl said, she stood up and she said, "For the first time in my life, I feel happy. I feel like this is the first time in my life where I've been around people who actually make me happy."
Yeah.
And she said, "Before this, I was suicidal and depressed."
Yeah.
In front of her, she said this in front of her parents. Her parents.
Takes a lot of guts to do that.
Huge guts. Yeah. Her parents then did not sign her up to the program. Imagine if your kid hopped up and said, "I'm depressed and suicidal, but I feel like there's hope," and you just went, "Nah." Like, it really frustrates me. And, you know, I think my perspective on this generation of parents has been very much quite negative just based on what I've experienced. Like, we had a similar scenario. We had one kid, he's been with me for a while. He was studying business. You know, business is such a waffle degree, I find. Like, I don't know what it is. So many people just jump into it because they want to be an entrepreneur or whatever. And he was studying business, and then he loved doing video. And I got him, he's doing video and he started his own company. He's going crazy. And I could see him going way too hard, way too fast. And I knew he was going to burn out and crash.
Right.
But I was like, but he's 19.
you know?
I burnt down and crashed. It's going to happen. And yeah. then he picks himself up and he keeps going.
Yeah.
And he kind of burnt down and crashed. And then his parents leveraged that to go be like, "You, yes, we were right the whole time. See, you failed. See what should have happened."
Right.
And now, dude, like the depressing, he's we're worried about him. We're thinking about calling. Like he was, I'm not a doctor or anything, but I could tell he's depressed. His body language, he didn't speak unless someone spoke to him. Yeah. He just kind of sits there.
Withdrawn and, you know.
And his mom calls me a cult leader.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. But I would love to have a chat with her and, you know, just be like, look, why do you have this belief? Exactly as you say. Like, if you remove the fact that, just try to think, is it a belief that has been ingrained in you or is it something that you've made consciously?
Yeah.
Most people, it's ingrained.
Yeah.
Yep. And this is the whole thing when we talk about young people. It's like, this is okay. You just understand that you're in control of your life and you have the opportunity to slow down. You don't have to jump into anything. Really think about what you want to do. Yep. We put almost zero effort into our career in high school. I didn't. My career advisors didn't really do much. I don't even know what a career advisor does I don't know what they do. I didn't get help from them and I didn't really have any external help except for podcasts. And that's what got me into podcasting.
Right, right.
Stuff like Gary Vee and all those guys who are putting out these messages. I was like, oh my God, for the first time in my life, I've heard a message that counteracts what everyone else is saying.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
You know, like the funny thing is that because obviously my main domain is like helping people like learn more effectively, right? Mm. And I work with like professionals and adults, but a lot of my work, like at least half of my work is with students, you know, and academic learning, you know, studying. And I find a really similar thing. Like for example, if I'm having a consultation with a student for the first time and I say, okay, well, let's do like a look at the way that you're studying. And then they've been like stressed and they're burning out and they're frustrated and they're like studying heaps of hours to do whatever. And then I look at the way that they're studying and I look at their techniques and I think like, there are many parts of this that are very, very suboptimal. And yes, it's the way that, you know, a lot of people tend to commonly study, but a lot of people commonly have very suboptimal study techniques. And I just pointed out to them why each of these things probably produces this type of result. And I'd said, no, this is typically what they would find. Mm. And then they started crying because it was the first time that they'd ever actually felt that they weren't an idiot. It wasn't that they were dumb,
right,
that they couldn't achieve this. It was just that these techniques were not optimized for them. So they'd created this entire set of self-limiting beliefs about what they, you know, can and can't do based on, you know, these techniques that they were using. And then when you know, those self-limiting beliefs are gone, like there's an entire door that opens up in terms of what they could and could not possibly achieve. And I think sort of in this case, it's like an academic context, but like in general, like these sort of self-beliefs that we place on ourselves from the way that we were parented or our culture or the society or whatever, like it impacts us so deeply, you know, in every action and behavior and thought that we have. And in some cases, those beliefs, even if it doesn't feel like it, can be damaging in ways that you don't draw the connection. Like you don't necessarily draw the connection that this belief is causing this kind of symptom.
It's subconscious.
Yeah.
And beliefs we teach, you know, beliefs are formed by references we have. And references are created in our past. You know, you might have references that happened from when you're a child and that's the reason you have a belief.
Mm.
You know, no one's born a confident public speaker.
Yeah.
But you might not be confident because you've got all these references that said, well, when I raised my hand, I got laughed at in class.
Yeah.
And all these things are the reason that you have this belief. It's not your fault. We have references that happen in our past. And a lot of it comes from before you're 7 years old. And a lot of it still happens now.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's important to give people positive references.
Yeah.
Like I did a talk the other day, very nervous for it. And I got phenomenal feedback. I can't tell you the confidence I have now on that talk because of the references I was given. And it's a huge thing because I was similar. I was not good at school.
Yeah.
I was not bad, but I had to put in more effort than my friends for worse results.
Mm.
You know, I'd get 70s.
Yeah.
But in order for me to get 70, and I don't know if people are just lying, but everyone would be like, I've barely studied for it. Yeah. I'm sitting here just like.
A lot of people are lying. Like, I can tell you objectively.
They are lying?
As the person that is working with a lot of these students, right? Like, and it's worldwide. Like we've got, you know, students in every single country. Consistently, you know, students are always trying to appear like they're trying less.
Naturally
smart.
They're
smart. They're naturally smarter than their peers. You know, they don't want to say that they were studying a certain. Or sometimes it's the opposite.
They say
like, oh man, I studied like this amount of time, but no, it actually didn't. They sat at a desk for that amount of time where half the time was spent getting distracted or
like, maybe that was me. But like, I don't know. I just, you know, a big reason I only made this connection recently, a big reason I didn't go to university because I got into university mm-hmm. for film and media.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be a filmmaker. I just couldn't see the value in a film degree. I was like, I'll just go do it. Yeah. But another big reason was I hated exams and I was so bad at exams. The idea of going straight into another 3-4 years of exams made me sick to my stomach. Yeah. I was like, I can't do this because I got top marks in New South Wales for my two major works. I rebuilt a motorbike and I did a video for visual arts and I got 50 out of 50 for both. I got into Art Express because they were projects and I loved it. Everything else, you know, super average because it was all exam based.
Yeah.
And I just, my mum would sit me down and just like, you've got to read the question. And I'm like, what does that mean? I am reading the question. And she, you know, I think I do have some mild form of learning disability, especially now. Like I just, I skip words. I read, like I just skip things. I'll read stuff and I'll skip the most obvious things. And I once posted a podcast episode with a huge spelling mistake in it. And I couldn't even see it. I wrote how twice.
Right.
It said, how did Justin achieve this or whatever? Right. And I looked at it for 10 minutes. I'm like, where's the spelling mistake?
Right.
And so my point is,
yeah,
I really had a belief that I wasn't that smart as well.
Yeah.
Because of school, I didn't do well in exams. And because of that, I didn't think I was very book smart, but I did recognize that I was good at projects and I was good at other things and creativity. And I tried to double down on that.
Yeah.
So,
you know, the interesting thing actually, you know, because you talked about this idea of like, you know, like a learning disability sort of thing. One really interesting thing that I found, which I completely did not expect to find when I was sort of, you know, running my program and things. I haven't like extensively studied this, you know. I'm not imminently planning on publishing about this either. So, you know, with a grain of salt, but like I've observed that I have a lot of people that have come into my program with certain like processing deficits, and these sort of diagnosed learning disabilities that have sort of been diagnosed based on the experience that they've had going through school and academics and things. And then when they go through the program and they learn different techniques that actually work on, so most people don't realize this, but most common techniques that people are using to study and learn are not actually based on what the research says, how the brain actually works.
Yes.
So a lot like of the
sitting down, just writing and stuff.
Yeah. So the overwhelming majority of techniques that the overwhelming majority of students use are not actually supported by research to produce the results that they actually want to reach. So like the one that, I mean, it's kind of like the video that sort of propelled my YouTube a little bit is I kind of talked about the idea of doing flashcards, like Anki, spaced repetition, things like that. The research on flashcards and repetition show that it can be effective, especially in the short term, very short term, like day to week, for recalling individual isolated facts. There is no research that actually says that it helps you for solving more complex problems.
Yes.
Or holding on to that information in a meaningful way.
Yes.
And there's also no research to show whether it's actually even a good technique to use if you have like multiple things you're learning and sitting real assessments. They're usually like lab-based studies where they give them like a set of information and they test it on them like a day later.
It's black and white. Where like you've memorized it, you can regurgitate it, that's done.
And even the thing you're regurgitating is not necessarily relevant to the context of what you actually study in real like school or for example. Yeah. But it's arguably the most common technique that students use. Some studies show that up to 80% of all students at a college level use something like flashcards and spaced repetition. So when we look at how the brain actually works, and research has only started to clear this up in the last 3 to 5 years, when we actually look at how the brain works and when we design techniques and strategies that fit how the brain works as step number one, what I actually saw was that all of the issues that these people had come into the program thinking and getting diagnosed with learning disabilities for just disappeared. They fundamentally just stopped having those problems because they just stopped using techniques that were going against the way that their brain actually wanted to learn in the first place.
And you know, I can totally see that. And again, this is just based on my experience, but I've had to figure it out myself.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I present for 12 hours a day. I've had to learn 12 hours of content. You know, I could barely learn a 10-minute speech in high school. Yet here I am doing literally 12 hours on stage, 2 days back to back, communication skills, money and finance. But how do I learn that? I don't know. I just learn it. Like I don't learn what to say. I just learn the content so I know it back to front without even having to think. And then I just get up there and I can speak to it. And I have key points. We don't use PowerPoints.
Yeah.
I don't use any PowerPoints. I get like four pieces of a note. I get four key points for like a four, you know, 2.5 hour presentation. Yeah. And it's like, younger me never would have imagined that was possible mm-hmm. because of the way I was taught.
Yeah.
But now I realize some other strategies, and I've been working with my mentor who teaches me presentations, and I use Notion. I don't know if you know Notion.
Yes.
And I map everything out in there, and I drag and drop it, and I put my key points, and I wrap everything in stories. So I call them story triggers. Mm-hmm. So when I start with a new idea, I associate it with a story, which gets across that idea, and that sets me up for the rest of it. And I've figured all this out. Mm-hmm. And it would have been nice to have been taught this.
Yeah.
You know, at least be, maybe not taught, but allowed to figure out, or like provided the different learning styles so that I could figure out which one was for me.
Yeah. So like my main thing is the idea that there are things that your brain will do to learn more effectively. And you were fortunate enough that you actually were able to figure it out. And obviously you work to figure it out. A lot of people will never either put in the work or be like, because it's not motivating really to do something you suck at. Like if you suck at learning in school, most people are not going to be motivated to like improve that. You can just sort of avoid it. But my main thing is that we can take all of those processes that we know actually work, and we can essentially like weaponize it. Mm. We can bring it into a fully integrated system, and we can just get rid of all the stuff that doesn't work. Mm. And when you do that, you know, it's like a well-oiled machine. You know, most people that I work with, it's frankly pretty rare to see someone that can't achieve pretty well if they get their system sorted. You know, it's really, really rare. Like I would say of the students that I've worked with, and I'm approaching probably around 10,000 students that I've worked with now, maybe I can think of four students across the last, you know, almost decade that I've been doing this.
It's where like the growth and fixed mindset, right?
Even accounting for that, because we teach about growth mindset as part of it, because it's like a difficult thing to learn. So you have to have that growth mindset to push through. But like, even if they have the growth mindset, and even if they kind of adopt that, and they're trained in that, and then we teach them the techniques and all that sort of stuff, like when we have that, the results are like pretty consistent. There's very, very few people that really can't just get it. They usually, you know, have a certain thing in their technique. Like that's the thing that you need to work on. When they fix it, it gets fixed. It's really uncommon for it to be like about them, like as a person. It's not like you are limited in this way.
That's a belief so many people have.
Yeah,
they think it's about them. Oh, I'm not smart.
Yeah,
it's like, well, hold on, that's not true. That's just a belief you have based on past references. Maybe you didn't do well. Like me, my references were, well, I worked hard and I didn't get good results on exams, therefore I'm not smart. And you know, that's kind of where I had that belief from. And then I entered the real world and I went, oh wait, a lot of this doesn't actually matter.
Yeah.
And when I actually started working on like the presentations I do now, I'm fascinated by it. I love communication skills. I love teaching money and finance. I love talking about emotional intelligence. And so because I love it, it's so much more interesting to learn versus biology, and it's applicable. Because I interviewed a woman, she's got a PhD in cognitive brain science, and I forget the term, but it was like a big issue with what we learn at school is we don't see the applicable, how we can apply it. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't care about learning Pythagoras' theorem because I knew I'd never have to learn it.
Yeah.
And if it's something I know I'm going to learn, use, I'm much more likely to learn it. Mm. And that's another issue.
So there's this like evolutionary theory around like how learning happens, right? Is that like the brain consumes a lot of energy. You know, it's like 20% or so or more of your daily caloric intake is consumed by your brain, even at rest. And so learning and holding on to information, and this thing that we call encoding, which is the idea of taking information, storing it in our memory so we can actually retrieve it later. Mm. That is an extremely energy consuming process. It's frankly tiring. Mm. If we were to hold on to every piece of information that we're bombarded with, every license plate, every color, every sound that we hear throughout a day, our brain would just explode.
We'd go insane.
Yeah. And you know, we have to eat like 30 pizzas a day just to think, so our brain is really, really efficient. It's a survival mechanism that's been built into the brain. If this information is not relevant, get rid of it immediately. Do not expend energy to hold on to this information. A lot of the stuff that we learn, our brain does not have a frame for why it needs to hold on to it. So no matter how hard you intend, how hard you will it to be held on to, your brain will do a very poor job at actually holding on to that information. Whereas if we implement, let's say, different techniques that start by priming the brain to understand why something is relevant to begin with.
Yeah.
Even a topic you're not interested in, even if your teacher is terrible, even if you have struggled with it your entire life, there are techniques that can be used to prime your brain to say, this is relevant. So when you learn it, it immediately forces it to hold on to that information. You just have to, you know, eat like a few more almonds to make up for the calories. But like the, you know, it's if you think about it logically, if you're learning stuff that is completely irrelevant to you and you're feeling that you can't remember it, it's actually like really normal, right? We shouldn't be in this position where we're saying, I'm an idiot. I'm like, I can't achieve anything because I can't learn irrelevant information and hold on to it forever. It's like, why, you know, why would you even be good at that to begin with?
And why do we consider that smart?
Why, yeah.
Why, do we why is that smart? Smart when you can regurgitate, memorize information?
Yeah.
It's like, that's not smart.
Yeah.
Something in it, first of all, that was such a good little rant there, because how do I preframe every talk and empower you? When I'm teaching communication, the very first thing I say is, did you know the number one skill that employees are looking for is this topic? Right. What I'm about to reveal to you.
Yeah.
We taught these skills to someone, they got a raise 3 weeks later using the strategies. We prime them to go, okay, why do I need this? This is the, if you want to get a job, this is the number one skill that you need. What is it? Communication skills. Okay, now they're interested. It's relevant to their life.
Yeah.
And then I was going to say, my auntie, who is also Asian, she's from Hong Kong, similar to you, works super hard, like working big hours, super driven. And she got flown over to work in Singapore in a corporate that she works for. And she's going mad because she's got all these execs and people who are high up who did well in high school, and they have zero problem solving abilities.
Yeah.
If you give them one thing outside, they shit the bed. They don't know what to do.
Okay. The thing though, curriculums are starting to get smarter. And we've seen this over the last 10 years. Curriculums are starting to assess in ways that reflect real world problem solving a little more accurately. It's a slow progression, but students that are sitting exams, like people that are sitting the year 12 exams in Aussie today, are sitting a different exam than what people were sitting 3 years ago, 6 years ago. You know, the questions that are starting to come out are more abstract.
Mm.
They're more decontextualized. They're more integrated, and they're just starting to get a little bit trickier. So all of the ways that we thought of learning and studying that could work for, like, let's say your parents' generation, and they're saying, hey, you know, you should do this because it worked for me, doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah.
Just frankly doesn't apply in every way, cognitively, scientifically, and also
in the world,
in terms of the assessments themselves. It's not even going to apply. Everything is changing towards that. So, but what the good thing is that we are actually in like an interesting time in terms of opportunity, because the things are changing, but the methods that people are studying are not changing yet. You know, people are still studying like how their parents used to study.
Mm.
So if you can change that right now, probably won't be the case 10 years from now, but right now, that is a massive competitive advantage.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. Dude, this is what I say to so many people. I'm like, you have to understand the advantage of what the world we're in right now is it's so easy to stand out as a young person. Yep. All you have to do is go a little bit beyond. Most people are here, like it's so easy to stand out. If you have some communication skills, some good emotional intelligence, critical thinking, you can problem solve. People are begging for that in employers, employees.
You know, the thing is that I think this is really important to mention here is that this is not their fault. Not their fault that, for example, they may struggle with critical thinking skills or, you know, problem solving or, you know, getting that little bit extra. Mm. The idea is like the entire system was built in a way that did not facilitate that.
Mm.
Based on, you know, old research and, you know, outdated ideas, we built an entire system, an entire educational system that does not facilitate that whatsoever.
Mm.
So the expected outcome will be an entire generation of people that will lack some of these skills. And we're also now seeing employers and, you know, people that are, you know, in these positions of power recognizing that these things are deficient and wanting more of that.
Mm.
And so like that's like the scene that's been set here is that you essentially have a system that's kind of leveled it for everyone, that's pushed everyone down.
Mm.
So if you're the one person that can see that actually it's been pushed down, if I do things a little differently, that can really give me a significant edge. Then I think that, you know, that's like a really, really powerful tool to have in your toolkit.
It's so powerful. And I'm just pulling up a quote here because this is a Tim Ferriss quote. I'm not sure if you've heard it. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
I know Tim Ferriss, but I don't.
Here it is. This is Tim Ferriss. 99% of people in the world are convinced they're incapable of achieving great things. Therefore, they aim for mediocrity. The level of competition is thus fierce for the realistic goals, paradoxically making them the most time and energy consuming. And I'm like, oh, because so many people are just going for the mediocre stuff. And it's like, if you just go a little bit above, you'll see there's not much competition.
Yeah. You know, the weird thing, right, is that like I ask, like when I do like webinars and seminars with students, one of the questions I tend to ask in almost every one that I do is I get people to say, what is your goal, right? And they usually aim, because I work with a lot of sort of higher achievers as well. A lot of them are aiming for like a 99.95 ATAR.
Yeah.
Or they're aiming for
to give context, is like the top mark you can get in high school.
It's the highest possible mark that you can get in the Australian system in high school. Roughly represents the top 0.05% of national ranked achievement.
Yeah.
So like if you're doing IB, for example, you know, the top 50 out of 50, you would get a 99.95 translated.
Mm.
So a lot of people are aiming for this. And actually to get into some university like programs, the minimum to get into it is a 99.9, like a 99.85 is the minimum. These people are aiming for these marks that only like the top less than 1% of people are getting.
Yeah.
And I say, okay, so like, what are the ways that you study? And it's essentially like 3 to 4 items listed, like everyone uses. Everyone's like, I do heaps of past papers. I, you know, use my space for repetition and I use my flashcards and I just make sure to, you know, revise my notes, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, or like I pay attention to like, or I write notes and, you know, something really, really simple.
Mm.
And then I think like, okay, if you have something that, you know, if we take 100 people that got a 99.95, that got the top mark, and we ask them what technique you use, and they gave you those 4 items, would you say that those techniques work?
Yeah.
But we shouldn't, because let's say we took 1 million people, and of the 1 million people, let's say all 1 million are using those 4 techniques.
Mm.
Let's say only 100 of them actually succeeded.
Right.
We take the top 100. What techniques did they use?
Because that's an interesting point.
So the common things are common. Mm. It doesn't make them exclusive.
Are just good at those 4 things.
Not necessarily good at those 4 things. It could be something else. So what we need to think is, what are those top people exclusively doing
that
other people are not doing? So the idea of studying or learning or really anything in a way where you're trying to get an uncommon result, but you're doing it in a way because it is the common way to do it, does not make sense.
Yeah.
Common results and common. So if you want an uncommon result, there has to be something that's uncommon. There has to be something that's there that other people are not just doing.
Mm.
So that's why if you look at it like, if you look at all the people that use, you know, flashcards, for example, this is one of the big things, is that when you looked at people that use flashcards and past papers, we found that like 70% of people getting the top grade band use flashcards and past papers. We also found that 70% of students at every other grade band were using it.
Mm.
So now the question, so it's that redundant. Changes the picture completely.
Yeah.
Changes, and most people don't think that. Most people are not taking the extra step to think about the success rate of a technique. They're just looking at what is common among people that are successful without seeing all the failures. And I'm 100% sure, I don't even have to ask you. I know you know people that have used an approach, done something because that's the way that you're meant to succeed.
Yeah.
And they didn't get the result.
Yeah.
They weren't able to, you know, there's a lot more people that do something and will not get the positive result. But how many of those people are going to make a podcast, make a TikTok, make a YouTube channel saying, hey, everyone, look at me fail.
Yeah, you know?
People aren't going to do that. So you only hear about the success stories. And so you just keep thinking, like, that's the way to do it. That's the way to do it. That's the way to do it. But maybe it's not. It's just a thought and like a question that I hope people would ask themselves.
I love that, though. I love this conversation getting deeper, right? Because it's such a good point. Because logically, you'd say, well, everyone, the top, you know, 1% use flashcards, but so do the other 99%. Therefore, it's redundant. If everyone's using it, then that's not what made them into the top 99%.
Yeah.
And the other issue is, keep in mind, like, it's a big supply and demand.
Mm.
Like, my mum, she's an occupational therapist, and so she has a business, and she's always looking for a good quality team. And she's getting really worried because it's such a high demand for OTs. They're raising the ATAR required to get into it.
Right.
And she's like, I don't want that, because as an OT, you have to be customer facing. You have to have good communication skills.
Yep.
And all the high ATAR people they're attracting are just good at reports.
Right.
They're not good at customer facing. And she's like, no, I don't want this. And so again, it's just kind of going into the other point. I'd love to get your opinion. Sorry. So I know on the kind of like the ATAR thing is, because there's a story I always talk about, and it was like a friend of mine, she got like a 95 ATAR, which is very good.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, I could be in law, I could go into medicine. She could kind of do whatever she wants because you get a few bonus points and you hit the top.
Yeah.
And she became a teacher, which is a 75 ATAR.
Super unconventional
choice. And people said, here's what they said, why would you waste your potential on that?
I've heard exactly the same story from other people as well.
Waste your potential? Really common. Don't we want those people teaching the next generation of kids?
Exactly.
Like,
it's perverse.
It's just, and it's disgusting, because the way we view teachers in Australia is like lower status than a lawyer or a doctor. For what reason?
Yeah.
Isn't education one of them? I think education is the most important thing. It's the building blocks of our society. If we can fix our education, we can fix a lot of problems that's happening in this country.
That's actually the reason I got into education. I was like, man, there are a lot of problems. Not just in like Australia, but
the world, or
New Zealand, but the world. And I'm like, I cannot solve these. Like, I need to help other people solve these. And the thing with this teachers thing, right, is like, because I work with secondary schools and universities as well, and I end up having conversations with teachers about these things. You know, like when you're in the lunchroom and you're kind of complaining about, you know, your job and like sharing stories. Every teacher that I talk to realizes that there are problems in the system.
Yes.
And but the system is so big. It's so hard to change. Mm. And when we talk about the idea of like the qualification of being a teacher, you know, it's societal status and things, that's actually a really Western view in some places. So in some countries, being a teacher is really respected.
Like Finland.
Yeah, actually, yeah, exactly.
And they get paid well.
And they get paid much more. And so you see that there is actually a translation to better outcomes, to better results. Now, is that all that needs to change? No. Like the system is a complicated beast. But I mean, if I think back to my own educational history, and I think back to like the good teachers that I've had and the influence that they had on me, the fact that that is such a tiny minority of all the teachers I interacted with, and I could list a long list of teachers that I had that I thought like they, like, how do you even get a qualification? You know,
Because it's all exam. They don't like. I've spent the past 18 months learning how to present and keep kids engaged 12 hours straight.
Yeah.
I spend every day, I'm working on new stories. We use anchoring, NLP, we take a deep breath in, we use dancing, we use games. Like so much psychology is involved just to give them the best possible experience.
Yeah.
It's almost insulting to me when someone like a professor or a teacher hops up because they're an expert in the field, but they've done zero work on their presentation skills.
Dude, do you know when I first encountered that exact thing?
Yeah.
I did my teaching certificate, right? Which is the certificate that you need to teach adults and be like a lecturer or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, there's this big group of people that are all getting their certificate. And I realized that, because this was not at my university, it was at another university.
Mm.
And I was like, why are there no people from my university in this? Like, this is kind of the certificate that you get for this.
Mm.
And then I looked into it deeper and I realized at the university I went to, there is no teaching training. And I looked into it even deeper. I even was able to connect with one of my former lecturers. And what he told me was that the entirety of the training that he got for teaching was that the night before his lecture, they gave him a USB with the old lecture slides on it.
Oh my gosh.
That was it. There was literally—
How is this legal?
No, exactly.
How, like, it's so insulting to me because it's like, I wouldn't, just because I know the words to a song doesn't mean I can get up and play it as a musician, right? Just because you know the content doesn't mean you have the right to get up there and present. You need to be like, you should be putting work into that.
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating to me because I've been in, you know, training for, and I see how much work goes into it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you look at the good teachers, scan through your life, any listeners or yourself as well, you can think, I had an economics teacher, he came in for one class and it's the only class I remember. He was phenomenal, so engaging. We were writing hands up, answering questions. Every other class with my main teacher, we were just writing in a book. Yep. We were just highlighting on a textbook.
Yep.
And economics is so dry. It's so hard to read when you're like 16
yeah.
and you're highlighting key points. Like, what the hell does this mean? And it's just...
And then you start thinking, oh, that's the way that I should learn because that's why my teachers are telling me to. They don't know.
No, because half the teachers haven't even been in the real world. Again, look, I love teachers and I have a lot of teachers reach out to me and I want to support them. And I want, again, it's the education system as a whole.
Yeah.
But the other issue is when we view teachers as lower in society, it means we don't attract the highest quality people. And a lot of people use it as their plan B.
Well, even I think like, even if we were to take the same teachers, if we could actually give them more opportunity and chance to upskill, get more training, but like let alone have time for upskilling and training.
Mm.
Most teachers don't even have time to even do their job description, like marking papers, grading exams, things like that. A lot of teachers don't even get contracted hours to do that. They do that in their own time.
During the evening while over dinner.
Yeah. So like one of the first things that I tried to do years ago was start doing some training programs for teachers, like help, because I was observing things that were happening with their students.
And you know, I met someone who does that today.
Oh yeah,
I'm not even kidding. He is a professional. He does personal development for teachers.
Yeah,
he's about to present at the youth summit. I met him 3 hours ago.
Yeah, that's
crazy. I'll have to introduce you because I've got to chat with him.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, I think that they probably hit the bill a lot better because when I tried to do that, I got massive pushback from teachers and schools because they were just categorically averse to doing any additional work because they were already so damn burnt out from just trying to cover their job description. Yeah. The idea of having more was just, you know, there were like a few teachers that were like keen, often like younger teachers that still had like life and
everything
in them and he like crushed out in the system yet. But yeah, it was like super demotivating because I was like, cool, let's like, I've got all this data from like, you know, the students that you just, you know, graduated from your high school. I'm working with them in uni now. I'm seeing how they're doing. Like I've got all this data on them. I've got all this feedback and I've got like, you know, they remember this part in your class, but they didn't remember this part. And then like, you know, I went through that and built an entire program so that we could go to the teachers and be like, let's change the way that we're teaching to make it more manageable for you, you know, reduce your workload as well as improve better outcomes.
Yeah.
And most people were like, oh, I don't know, like don't have much time to, you know, do anything. And it's just, you know, kind of not really like mentally clocked out, but just don't have any energy left to dedicate to.
Dude, I honestly think in years to come, we're going to look back at our education system and be like, not even, we're just going to be like, how the hell did we let that go that long?
Yeah.
How do we get this far? Like, how are we in the 2022 world of, you know, everything that's happening and we're still learning stuff from like the 1900s?
There's that. Not even the 900s, bro. It's like 18. The 1600s.
Yeah.
The current education system, it like has changed. Okay.
Obviously education, stuff has changed.
Yeah.
But the root, like the fundamentals of a blackboard is now just a whiteboard.
So the funny thing is, right, is that one of the first things that like I sort of stumbled across and it really like triggered my curiosity about learning and got me into like one of these rabbit holes was I was listening to like, I think it was like a podcast on something and I was talking about like just big developments and inventions that were made. And one of the biggest inventions that's been made in human history is a printing press, right? The Gutenberg press.
Yes.
And the Gutenberg press was created in, I think like the end of the 1500s or like early 1600s or something. And it got me to think, like, what do we do before that? Like, what were we doing before we had, like, mass available books? And so I was looking at, like, well, and that's one of the things that started getting me into the topic of, like, how does the human brain actually do this thing that we call learning in the first place? Because we normally think of, like, learning and studying, and often we think about writing, reading, and books, you know? It's uncommon for someone to think about studying or learning and not have like books and reading as part of that.
Or like a library sitting down with pens.
Something like that, right? And then it's like, okay, let's get rid of all of that. What does learning look like anymore? It's like talking to someone? Like it's weird, it's vague. And so one of the things I realized was that, you know, the human brain essentially, by the 1500s, 1600s, like human brain has not like adapted and evolved more over the last like 400 years. It's like the same brain, right? Yeah. But the entire education system was built around that because it was the first time we were able to mass publish information and distribute it through books, through the printing press. And so we had an entire system of teaching and learning that was built around books, left to right, down the page, reading information, consuming it linearly.
Yeah, taking
completely notes. Passively.
Yeah.
And then that just became the standard way to do things. Yet that, like not that, that all of that is fully artificial. Yes, there are parts of our brain that were that have, you know, special functions of reading and writing, but they're small. They're small parts of the brain. And learning doesn't occur there. Learning occurs when that data is pulled to other parts of the brain. There's this very complicated processing and consolidation that we still don't really know how it works right now. That is where the learning actually occurs. So for us to pin, like, you know, learning on just the fact that we're like reading something, or even to take it a step further and say, because I can't do this incredibly artificial way of learning, therefore my brain must be deficient.
And you're not smart.
And you're not smart is just insanity.
Yeah.
Is insanity.
I mean, you look at who do we think are smart? Einstein, all they did was problem solve, you know? And we, for some reason, we don't count problem solving as, you know, like smart anymore. It's all like, you know, following what you're taught. Whereas like the smartest people in the world were the ones who came up with solutions and solved problems and like thought of stuff that didn't even, we couldn't even comprehend.
Yeah.
There's like that quote, I love it. It's kind of like the main quote from, I guess, probably what you do in my podcast and stuff. Well, not a quote, but like a story. It's like, if you were to go back in time 100 years ago, let's imagine the 1920s, everything would look different. The cars we drive would be different. This clothes we wear would be different. The rights are different. The one thing that is the same is the education system. Yeah. There's still teachers on a blackboard drawing up, teaching math, English, and science, and the kids are sitting on their desk taking notes.
Yeah.
Now we just do a whiteboard and a little bit more technology, and it's adjusted a little bit, of course.
Okay.
But the fundamentals are the same.
You know the thing that has made that progression really hard? And this is something that I noticed, like, just didn't make any sense. And now researchers are starting to realize it doesn't make sense as well. So we have educational research, right?
Mm.
Cool. Like educational research is meant to make things better.
Mm.
So we say, okay, we're going to teach people. We're going to teach people something. So we need a researcher to make sure that we're teaching in a better way. Mm. So in the 1920s, the teaching techniques was different. You know, this a field called pedagogy, right? Like pedagogy was different. The way that we thought we should teach people was different. It's changed a lot since the 1920s. From the 1970s onwards, the research had like this huge explosion of like understanding, instructional design, all these things changed. Mm. Okay. The format of how we taught remained the same in the classroom and all of that. But the techniques that we used, the way we delivered information, the way we tried to engage people, the way that we got feedback, all of that changed because there were years and thousands, tens of thousands of studies that were looking on it. Except most of those studies were measuring their success based on whether they passed or failed the curriculum that they were sitting in.
Mm.
And then concurrently, there's research saying, well, how applicable even is that curriculum for them in like other parts? Like, does that actually translate to something meaningful? So we ended up having sort of like decades of research that was in like a very closed box where it was like, let's set the parameters for success.
Yeah.
Do we tick the parameters for success? Let's keep optimizing for these parameters of success. Great, they're reaching these higher rates of success. That's getting better, it's getting better. But when you look outside of that box, what is that actually translating to?
Yeah.
Sometimes worse outcomes, worse critical thinking, worse mental problem solving. Way, you know, mental health, one of the only diseases in humanity that is getting worse every year. You know? So, and when you look at studies and youth surveys on mental health.
Oh, shocking.
One of the prominent reasons for it is academic pressure.
Yeah.
You know?
Academic pressure and what I've seen is loneliness. Australia Talks released stats saying that, like, you know, 39% of people aged 18 to 25 are either incredibly lonely or like relatively lonely.
Yeah.
That's what I say at schools. I say, you know, I think go work as hard as you can at school, go for the highest possible mark, but don't sacrifice your mental health and your social life sort of thing. It's like, just school shouldn't be that high pressure. You're only a kid. You want to enjoy your life. Like, and you know, there's been studies that have shown that taking breaks and like having hobbies and stuff outside of work,
it just
makes you more productive when you're in.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. And I mean, like, I don't want to like sound like I'm just like plugging my work too much, but like, that's the reason why I am so like, I push so hard for this is because I know that academics and, you know, academic achievement and the grades, like they're going to be important for people, you know,
of course.
And there are some degrees where it really is important and that's fine. And you can still find it important and you can still prioritize it, but it's possible to still do well and not sacrifice your life or your mental health. It's not mutually exclusive. Mm. If you have better skills and if you have better techniques and you're doing something that is not just the common thing that everyone else is doing, expecting to do better, because yes, maybe you can get a better result, but the only differentiating factor for you is going to be hard work and you're going to have to make up for that. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with working hard. I like to think that I have very good work ethic.
Yeah.
But hard work is not something that you want to pin everything on. You want to have a process that's more effective. Because when you put your hard work in, you're getting better results than everyone else, not just keeping up.
And it's like, you know, I always say work smarter, not harder. Yeah. It's like everyone says, should you work smarter, work hard? It's like, work smart.
Yeah,
like, work smart. Work hard as well. But it's like, you know, is someone working a 12-hour McDonald's shift, they're working hard.
Yeah. Exactly. But, like people with triple jobs.
Yeah. People, everyone works hard according to them. Everyone thinks they work hard.
So the thing that like, when people ask me that, cause that's probably like one of the top five questions I get asked, you know,
which is what, sorry?
Is like,
should you smarter work smart or harder?
Versus hard?
Yeah.
The answer I always give is work smart, then hard.
Yes. That's a good one.
And I think it has to be in that order. And this is something that I first realized in myself and I realize it consistently in my students. When you work hard and then smart, it doesn't work. Because when you work hard, you use up the available time that you need to learn how to work smart.
Very true.
And you develop more tunnel vision. You become more and more entrenched in just keeping up and working hard. So a lot of people that are studying really, really, really hard, they struggle to spend time to work smarter because they don't have any time left. They're just able to keep up with their effort. They don't have any more effort and time left for working smart. And in those situations, it's something that I call system entrenchment, which is that when you're entrenched in a certain way of doing something and you don't have any space to work on things that could really be a game changer, you're stuck. And that means that as challenges get harder, you will not be able to adapt. Mm. You'll be capped. Mm. And then what will happen is that your outcomes will reduce, either your mental health outcomes, your sleep, your, you know, well, just the grades themselves.
Yeah.
So if you, as soon as you realize you're entering into a state where I'm starting to get to the point, or I'm already in a point where I'm working so hard that I don't even have time to think about working smarter, that needs to be a big red flag.
Mm.
And you need to, and it's going to be difficult, but sometimes you need to bite the bullet and accept that in the short term, you're going to lose a little because you need to take a step back. We need to reduce the amount of effort. We need to reduce the amount of time. We don't reduce the effort because we're getting lazy. We reduce the effort because we know that we need to change something. We need time to change that. And then once we've changed that, we can ramp up the effort, you know, again, if we want to. But just making sure that the first number one priority is to work smart, because if you can work smart and then work hard, you know, you're unbeatable.
And because it's like, because you're working hard on something that is much more worthwhile your time.
Yeah.
Because you've worked smart first and now you're working on something that's probably leveraging your time.
Exactly.
Like what I'm working on is like all long-term.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can make a lot of money in the future because I've put in the work now because I've found something, building the business, I identified that the most valuable thing I could build was my personal brand.
Yeah.
Identified that very early on because I worked for a guy, he had a company called Key Person of Influence. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's all about becoming the key person of influence in your industry. They teach you how to write a book, how to publish content, how to nail your pitch and everything.
Right.
And all these different ideas. And that was my university, I call it, because I went to all of his events for free because I was filming him. And so that was my kind of upbringing. So I went, oh my God, your personal brand. If you've got a personal brand, you can kind of go anywhere. If you can speak, it's the highest paid profession in the world. So I'm like, all right, I want to be a presenter. That's a great way to get across my message and everything. And it's like, so once you can work smart and then transfer working hard into it, completely agree.
Yeah.
That's the sky's the limit.
Yeah. And like I, you know, similar for me is that when I was first working on education and my business and stuff, I didn't pay myself for my business for the first 4 years, you know, and the first time I paid myself was, you know, 37,000 New Zealand dollars, you know, which is like, what, like 30,000 Australian, you know, it was just enough to break even on my basic living expenses with absolutely nobody to save and no luxury expense, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's hard to do that if you've got all doctor friends who are making lots of money, buying nice watches, nice cars.
Yeah.
That's where you can get caught in the trap of, is this worth it?
But so there's this thing in the employability space that's called like the capitals model, where we talk about the different types of capital that you have. One of those things is called like human capital, like the degree that you have or the qualification. And yes, that goes to some extent, but then there's the other things like social capital, your agent capital, like your ability to motivate yourself and be self-effective and to network and to, you know, just be good at your job, you know, all of these sorts of things. And if you think about it in terms of the capital you're developing, you know, sometimes the money is not the worthwhile capital to be developing, you know, because like I had a 16-year-old kid that I used to work with like a few years ago. And I said like, hey, you've got like summer break coming up. You're really, really into cars. You know, they were like passionate about cars. I said, think about the ideal, you know, company that you would like to work for around cars that's, you know, in the city. You know, who's the person or the company that you would love to work for? Approach them and just say, I'm super, super passionate about cars. I don't have a lot of skills, but I would love to just intern here, do something and just be exposed to the environment and learn a little bit more about what it is to be in this industry. And he was like, oh, but like, I could be working part-time instead.
Oh,
and
I
was like, yes, you could be working part-time. Tell me how much money you would work if you worked almost full-time hours throughout this holidays as a 16-year-old. And they were like, $2,000. And I was like, you know, I make $2,000 a week, right?
Mm.
Just, you know, like as an adult, $2,000 is not a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then, but the skills to develop that, even as an adult, that exposure, that experience, that's those skills.
I completely agree. I'm a huge fan. I'm saying get coffee with people.
Yeah.
And offer to buy them coffee. I don't care if it costs you, like you pay for the coffee. Imagine if a young kid came to you and said, hey, I want to can I buy you coffee? I want to learn from you because you inspire me and I'm just curious.
Yeah.
How many people would say no to that?
You know,
not many people would say that.
I know you're going to be in the same position as me in that like lots of people will message you, you know, on
platforms. Yeah. You know?
And it's hard to keep on top of the volume and things.
Yeah.
I don't know if you get this as well, but I get a lot of people that come to me, you know, asking for advice and for help.
Yeah.
But they're willing to commit nothing to it.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying like buy my program or something. Just even like committing to it at an emotional level or sort of having some kind of like, you know, it's just like, you know, what do I do here? Tell me.
One of the flip charts we draw in the communication section is people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say, hey, I want to know something. No, show me that you care.
Yeah.
Hey, Byron, I listened to 10 of your episodes recently and they changed my life. Thank you so much for doing what you do. I'd love to ask you a few questions if you have time. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
You've just told me you've invested 10 hours into learning from me.
Yeah.
You're clearly interested.
Yeah. I can invest a minute to answer your question to, you know.
I'll jump on Zoom for 5 minutes. I'll send you an audio, do back and forth or something.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely succumbed to the early stages when the podcast was picking off. I do like 30-minute Zooms with people because I loved it for free.
And then I'm like, okay.
And then what I realized, a simple shift was just changing my Calendly link to 15-minute Zooms.
Right.
And then to like 6-minute Zooms.
Yeah.
And if they've only, because then they know if they've got 30 minutes, I'll take up the whole 30 minutes. If they've only got 10, then they'll only take up 10.
Yeah.
Now I don't promote it. Or if someone really wants to and they've shown me that they care enough,
yeah,
I'll do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Or even like, you know, like someone watches like one video, for example, and they're like, oh, this is so good. Like, let me ask, you know, this person directly about it.
Yeah.
It's like, spend a bit of time, like watch some of the other things maybe, you know, maybe that's already been covered, you know? And man, I don't know if you get this, but I get a lot of people that I really feel like they really like feel entitled to be helped. Like, there's a sense of like, you owe it to me to teach me this. You know, it's like, dude, I'm like pumping out stuff for free, like as best as I can. Like, I'm trying to help you through this way. Like, I just don't have time to sit there like my entire day just helping everyone, answering every single question, especially when they're not even willing to like put in a little bit more of the work themselves. And like, as an audience member, you understand that the person that you're watching, if you don't feel like the person that you're consuming content from cares about you, you're not going to find their content very relevant. Same thing, that, you know, the other way around is like, if I don't feel like you care about, you know, like my content or even about yourself and taking ownership of it seriously, I'm not really very motivated to spend that limited time to answer back.
This is what I mean. It's like, it's so easy to stand out. Because it's like, honestly so easy. It's
such
easy.
A low standard, this, honestly.
It is. The bar is so low for young people right now, which means it's great because anyone listening can now go, oh my gosh, okay.
Dude, have you ever like, have you done much in the way of like recruitment and hiring like young grads?
Yeah.
Or like young students and things like that?
Yes. And that's because through my program, it's almost a cool byproduct of my program is I almost naturally filter out the top talent. Like I have some freaking incredible young people that have listened to my podcast. I've gone through everything. Like, I can introduce you to some of them if you want. They're absolutely incredible. But again, it's 5 out of the 60 in my program. The 60 in my program were out of 10,000 people that saw the ad. It's like filtered down to these. Yeah. And once I find them, I hold on to them because they're so rare. And I'm just like shout out to Lily. Lily's an absolute superstar. I'm just like, I said to her, I was like, I don't want to lose you. Like, I want you to come work for me. I want you to like do this for me. Like,
Wait, let me ask you a question. Yeah. Is that based on what they know?
No.
And the skills? No. It's not, right?
It's completely attitude. Attributes she came to,
and,
she came to every single workshop. She took notes. She would message me with feedback. She also posts, she does her own podcast. She posts an episode every single day, a 2-minute episode, which shows me her work ethic and what she's trying to do with her life. She's so intentional. She's so high energy. She would show up, honestly. Yeah. There's kind of 3 things that we say, like, just show up. Stay in the race and do more than is asked of you. If you do those 3 things, not many people show up.
Dude, honestly, those three combinations,
that's what you need.
It's the top 1%. I think people sometimes have this view of what it takes to be in the top 0.1%, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And they're sort of put off, but they don't realize how much of a difference it makes when you do just a little bit more.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit more. When you put in 5% more than someone else, that differentiates you from 50% of the crowd. You put in 10% more, you're in the top 10%.
The Tim Ferriss quote, right? Everyone's fighting for mediocrity. Yeah,
exactly.
If you just go a little bit above, suddenly you're like, oh my gosh, there's not much competition here.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I guess the message to young people listening would be like, guys, take advantage of the times. Because, you know, I've got 14-year-olds. A 14-year-old girl reached out to me 2 days ago from, I don't know if you saw my story, from Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And she's like, hey, Byron, your podcast has changed my life. And I'm like, if there are 14-year-olds listening to this, imagine where they're going to be.
I did see this,
Imagine where they're going to be in 6, 7, 8, 10 years.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I didn't get onto this until I was like 21.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, man, look, this has been such a good, cool conversation, honestly. Awesome. Like I say that at the end of every podcast, I say that, but this has been like top for me. Like, this is almost like, if I say go listen to my podcast, this will be the episode because it's the most.
I love it.
It's the most like, this is what I'm all about.
Yeah.
You know, I've done episodes on niche things, but this is my philosophy. And to have you here with the data and the degree to back it all up and everything.
Yeah. I'm your qualification.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever I say a point,
push your message. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll be like, look, Justin said the same thing. He's a doctor. Well, listen, man, before we wrap up, what would your number one piece of advice be to an 18-year-old or a young person today?
Just zoom out a little bit. Just have a bigger perspective on things. Like, there's so few things that now that I think back on that I thought mattered when I was 18 really actually mattered, just take a step back and think about like what really is different. Mm. What, you know, don't just do things for FOMO. Don't just follow what is common just because it is the way it is. You know, don't just be like a sheep and like let your life, you know, take you where it is. Just take a little bit of a step back and just stop and evaluate, talk to more people and get that perspective. Like really take charge, make a decision about your life actively, not just
be intentional.
Be intentional. Yes, be intentional.
There's a thing I've kind of been saying. I don't know if you'd agree or not, but there's a thing. Yeah, I reckon you'll agree. I've kind of been saying, when you finish school, you have to spend the next 5 years unlearning all the habits and what you've been taught in school.
Yeah.
I found like that's actually how bad it is.
Like, that's like literally, like I have an actual module in my program dedicated on unlearning.
Wow.
For that very specific reason.
There you go.
Yeah. Some of my students will take 4 months just for that one module.
Just to unlearn.
Because there are so many habits that they built around it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like at school, if you look at someone, that's called cheating. In the real world, it's called collaboration and teamwork.
That's so funny. Eh?
Yeah. But yeah, man, yeah. Great advice. And this has been a great episode. For anyone who wants to join what you're doing, follow you on YouTube, get involved with everything.
Yeah,
where's the best place to go?
I would say if you want to learn more, like because you know you cover a broad range of stuff.
Yeah,
I really focus in a lot on like the learning and the motivation, procrastination, time management, stuff like that. So if you want to learn a little bit more about that, join that discussion. You know, YouTube, Justin Sung.
It's free. Yep,
it's free. Instagram at Dr. Justin Sung. I am trying to do more like live Q&A sessions as well through that. So if you can jump on at that time, that's good as well. I'm also planning on running a bunch of like mini webinars where I just dive on specific concepts that people have misconceptions about.
Mm.
And that's going to be in a huge series that I'm going to be running. Again, all of that will be free. And there's going to be hours and hours and hours of stuff there. Stuff that's not really appropriate for YouTube because it's a little too deep and a little bit too technical.
Mm.
But for people that are like really interested, I think that's going to be gold. And if you feel like you want to actually join the full program, then you just go to icanstudy.com.
Yeah.
And you can check that out. But by all means, what I would recommend is just get a taste for it first.
Yeah.
You know, consume some of the stuff that's out there. I've got so much stuff that's out there for free. Give yourself, you know, the chance at least to sort of just start exploring some of these ideas and changing the way that you're thinking and just dipping your toes in this a little bit first. And, you know, get used to the idea of like making some of these changes.
Yeah, amazing. So I'll put all those links you mentioned in the description below. So go check them out if you're interested. But otherwise, Justin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been awesome.
Sweet. Whew.
Cool.